Most people listening to this podcast will have considered some form of childcare. Babysitters, childminders, nurseries, nannies, it's a frickin' nightmare. Trying to find someone who's top-notch but flexible is the holy grail. The top-notch people seem to want to work 800 hours a week, and the flexible people, well, one budding babysitter once said to me, as long as you stay in the same room as them, it's okay, isn't it? If you're still looking for the right childcare arrangement, then maybe consider B&Co. They offer a highly individual, first-class service tailored to your needs. Their sitters are all creative people, actors, dancers, artists, which makes for a more engaging, creative experience. One sitter recently helped my kids at bath time, and when I came in the room, they were all pretending to be gorillas. But don't just take my word for it.
They really saved my bacon when I got a theatre job on a Friday afternoon that was starting on the Monday, and I had a 15-week-old baby, and B&Co sorted a group of brilliant women who turned up, and each day we had someone and they would play with our 15-week-old and then bring him on the bus to me so I could feed him at lunchtime and then take him back home again and then come and do the same the next day, and it made the job possible.
That's B&Co, who are offering £25 credit to anyone signing up using the referral code TRAPDOOR2019. Now back to the podcast. Welcome back. My guest this week is the multi-talented actor, comedian, writer, Marcus Brigstocke. He is a very good friend of my husband and myself. And so I thought I would Google him because I didn't have hard facts to hand. And I see here that at 19, Brigstocke worked on a North Sea oil rig and later as a podium dancer. I did actually know about the podium dancer thing, but not the oil rig. So he, as I say, has many gifts. You will know him from a lot. He's done a lot of radio stuff, The Now Show, Giles Wembley Hogg Goes Off, and more recently, The Brig Society. But he was also in Love Actually. He's been on Have I Got News For You, and he hosted a show on Dave called Argumental. I mean, you know who he is, so I'm going to stop reading his CV. We talked about lots of things, including, unpredictably for a parenting podcast, the invasion of Iraq. And for fact lovers out there, I interjected with the confidence of a late 20s estate agent, which I have sadly lots of experience right now. I said, oh yeah, that was 2002, mate. It was actually 2003. So I'm sorry if that leaps out at you as a horrific untruth. Fake news, fake news. Anyway, I recorded Marcus in his kitchen, and we started off by talking about the importance of fathers being present at the birth.
There's a weird thing about dads in attendance that we look at, you know, my generation of men and women look at dads and go, mine was bloody playing golf when I was born. And I don't think that going to play golf under any circumstances is okay. But I'm also not persuaded that the dad is always the right person to have in the room. Sometimes
that's
they're not.
Yeah.
Really not. Not helpful, not useful to their partner, you know. I mean, I'm sort of the view that you should be guided by mum in that instance, and basically if she says I want you here, then be there, you know. And I think there's sort of some social pressure now to say be here and don't go now. You made this happen. But I'm not persuaded that all men should be in the room. I'm glad I was, but ours was horrendous, and I didn't help.
Right.
because we were nice, like liberal, progressive people. And so when the NHS came to us and said, we're looking at a new sort of pain relief and wondered whether you'd be interested in being part of a trial. And we were like, anything to help.
Oh, God, I would have done that.
Yes, of course, yeah, because you're like at that stage, you know, relatively early Labour. It's OK. It's hard, but it's OK. And we're like, yes, of course, which, of course, meant that loads of extra monitoring equipment and all of that stuff was all bought in. And we were then in this sort of place where we didn't feel empowered to go, we're hating this. We can't move. There's all wires everywhere. Stop this. We don't want this anymore. It took us hours before eventually Soph was able to sort of go, I don't want this.
No, no.
And then I, you know, I was like, well, I mean, I'll talk to them, but this is pretty awkward. We have said we will do this. Like, no, what we're doing is definitely more important. So both our kids were emergency C-sections because of a thing, you know.
Not related to that.
No, not related to that. No, that it was going to, we now know that was going to happen.
Right, okay.
One of those things.
Yeah.
But it ended up being a really long way from what we'd thought.
What you'd imagined it would be.
Yeah. Which I think is probably true for everybody. To some degree.
I mean, luckily, I have no clue about anything. So I just thought, well, I'll just, whatever. I never understood why anyone even vaguely encourages you to have a birth plan, especially with your first. You have no fucking idea what it is. So what's the point in that?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, literally no point. Because you don't, you can't, it just is what it is.
Yeah. So obviously, I mean, you know this, but yeah, my ex-wife is now a doula. So she works with expectant parents and she's their ally. I mean, the point is when you have a baby, the midwife and obstetrician are on the side of health.
Yeah.
Not even on the side of the NHS. They're just on the side of get mum and baby through this difficult experience and make sure no one's injured or whatever, right? That's not to say they don't care. They certainly do. But they have a specific job to do.
Yeah.
And the midwife is not advocating for you as a family. That's not their job.
No, it depends on the midwife.
It does, of course. Of course.
The midwives we had absolutely
And they'll be on your... It's not that they're on your side, definitely.
Yeah.
But ultimately, their responsibility is to the NHS.
Yes, although I did find a massive difference between doctors that I met and midwives that I met. And we were really lucky with our midwives. They're very kind of like progressive to, you know, they do home births and stuff like that, you know. But they were all about, you know, my sort of holistic well-being. Was kind of almost the most important thing because that would then lead to everything else. You know, like if I'm relaxed and I'm happy, then, you know.
I mean, it's so essential that. And, you know, I mean, I've ended up understanding more about these processes and having a view on it informed by Sophie's position. I mean, one of the things is, broadly speaking, on your back with your legs in the air means you're working against gravity.
Oh, my God.
So try to avoid that. And monitoring in hospital and all that kind of stuff is like, you know, on your back is best for them.
Yeah. So when you're, because this didn't happen to us, but like, I guess if you're induced and things like that, if anything medical is happening, then you're going to be on a bed.
Yes, absolutely. And that's kind of the point, is that intervention happens quite early on.
Yeah.
And I'm not on board with that view of kind of like, listen, people have been having babies forever because actually it wasn't that long ago that the success rate of that process was quite low.
Yeah, exactly.
So that doesn't stand. But at the same time, the keenness to intervene based on all sorts of factors, you know, means that you get into a kind of spiral. But one of the things that happened was that, so it was a C-section and I was sitting topside, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I'm squeamish anyway, but this is now an open operation and blah, blah, blah. So it was actually with Emily, our second kid, and I was sitting topside. And when Emily came out, it was very nerve-wracking and I was sitting with my hands on my lap, very neat. And they passed Emily across me to Sophie to get skin-to-skin contact as soon as possible. And Emily's umbilical cord trailed across the backs of my hands, leaking the rest of what was still coming out of it.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely the wrong moment to go, oh, gross, or like, guys, I've totally got like umbilical stuff on me. So I just sat really still going, she's beautiful with this umbilical fluid. It literally, like, it trailed lightly and softly over the backs of my hands.
And did you wait for a moment where you could just surreptitiously shake it off?
Straight on the back of the trouser. Straight in the back of the trouser. Yeah.
Yikes!
How did having kids change your sense of self and the way that you sort of looked at life? Was it a gradual thing, or did it...
It was a bit weird for me. So I had an odd sort of late childhood, early adulthood, in that there was no late childhood. Adulthood went like that when I was 17, and there was a big intervention and I went into rehab. And, you know, I spent the first year, 6 months to a year, I knew people, became friends with them, shared our innermost secrets, and then they died. Because they relapsed. So I was thrust very hard into an adult world of very serious responsibility. So from the age of 19, I knew I wanted to be married and I knew I wanted kids. And I wasn't in a massive hurry to make that happen, but I was very single-minded about it. I was kind of like, anyone who I went out with, even when I was like 20, if I reached a point with them where I was like, I don't think we're going to get married, then it was over.
Gosh.
And I didn't stick around in relationships that didn't look like we were going to have babies together. So then they were over. There were a few lasted.
Like most guys. Most guys like
Like
that.
Most guys. Yeah. I mean, thank God I wasn't very vocal about this, because I think someone on a, you know, on a hormonal Wednesday afternoon might have gone, he's the one! So I'd known, and I was very excited to become a dad. The sense of responsibility obviously is, I wanted to say shocking. I don't know that I thought it was shocking, really. But it is massive. There's no two ways about it. It is absolutely massive. Oh, I mean, I drove back from the hospital so slowly.
Yes,
I mean, I literally crawled back from the hospital. Oh, I tell you what else I remember was an absolute sense of, frankly, ready to commit violence in the protection of my child. And so our babies were born at the Chelsea in Westminster, and we came out of hospital on a Chelsea match day. And so the football fans fill the hospital car park up completely with their cars for the football match. And I was like, there's a way the hospital can regulate this and have that not be the case, because some people need, not just us, frankly, where there's all sorts of ways we could have got our babies home, not that that ever occurred to us. So I was furious. Yeah. I was absolutely furious and hadn't been able to park and, you know, all of that. And then we came out, and there was sort of, as there were, lots of, frankly, perfectly nice people walking perfectly calmly down the road towards the football ground. Yeah. But the fact that they had football scarves on, I was like, if you step towards this vehicle, I will simply run you down. Everybody stay calm. And drove home at about 4 miles per hour. I literally, like, we probably stalled on a speed bump because I was going so slowly.
I remember that. I remember driving with Zach for the first time. It was absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
So funny, isn't it?
It's mad, isn't it? Yeah. Because you're suddenly aware, like, it reframes driving for you. Yeah. It's way bigger than when you, the day after you pass your test.
Oh, God, yeah.
It's like, oh, this really, really matters.
And also some people learn to drive because they've got kids. So that must be absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
So they've just learned to drive so that they can drive their tiny, precious baby around.
And then it doesn't take that long before you've got the car seat and you're going, I think it's in. It takes forever.
I was driving... If I say this, David will listen, I'll get into trouble. But I was driving around the other day and I could hear, we've got an Isofix and it kind of beeps if it's not
right.
in. And I could hear, I don't know which kid it was, but it was just going beep, 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 basically saying, I'm not really in properly.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh.
One of them's done it. It's all right.
Yeah.
We're popping to the shops. But then, and you know, I'm glad there are child seats like there are now. I'm glad there are laws like there are. But then also, you know, my dad had a, he had a van. And mum and dad sat in the front, and my sister and I loved it when we went in the van, which was just like a flatbed thing with some carpet square in it. And we just rolled around. Yeah, it was fantastic. Yeah. We go faster on the corners, Dad! Yay! And round we went.
My stepmom used to have an open roof, which was quite flash.
Yeah.
You know, and we would stand, she would drive along, little Renault 5, and we would stand up with our heads outside the car, and she'd just race down. I mean, I'm assuming she didn't go really fast. But yeah, it was
That's
the best
the
thing
stuff.
Ever. Imagine seeing a car.
Oh, you'd be straight on the phone. Child services, this is outrageous. Yeah. So, the sense of responsibility immediately went through the roof. And I do remember getting home with Alf, and there was definitely a feeling of like, what now?
Yeah.
Like, what do we do now? And the answer is nothing.
Nothing.
There's a really cool thing. I'm sure Sophie must have said this. I said this to you.
You said this.
Is it the pyjama thing?
Yes, and you said this to Anna Crilly, who mentioned it when I spoke to her.
Oh, that's so cool. I'm glad it's crept out. Well, just to remind people, so if you've just had a baby, stay in your pyjamas, and stay in your pyjamas for as long as you want, even some months, because people who come round to your house don't know when to leave. And when you're wearing your pyjamas, they'll go, I won't stay, because they know you're either you've just woken up or you're just on your way to bed.
Yeah.
And they can see that you're not. It's the people who get dressed and try to make themselves look nice and put some slap on.
Yeah.
And then afterwards they're like, my friend came home and she stayed for 4 hours and she wouldn't go. And you're like, wear your pyjamas.
I spoke to Carrie Ann and she said that she had friends that came over really early on. I mean, really early on. And kind of had a bit of a party downstairs, like we're boozing, and she was going,
oh my God,
I can't do this.
Yeah, get out of my house. Yeah. And you feel, I think, completely unable to,
you
know.
You want to be the same person. That's, I think, what's so hard. I don't think I would have known that.
Because
I would have thought, but I want to show that I'm still me.
Hey, this
is just, you know, so I'm just taking this in my stride.
There's time for that.
Yeah,
let that happen six or 12 months
who cares?
Later.
No, you're not really you.
No,
you have changed.
No, you've changed massively. Yeah, massively.
With it. It's okay.
Yeah. It's all different. I think we did basically manage that. I think I was pretty good at going.
You had to be the gatekeeper.
Yeah. And I think I was quite obviously also, you know, with the job that I have. I wasn't having to dash off to work very much in the early days. But I perhaps I'm rose-tinting it. I do remember enjoying it.
Yeah.
I remember the, you know, the gooey gazing, just kind of like going, wow, this is wow. And just staring at this beautiful little ball and, you know, and those weird little noises they make and the little... their hands kind of opening and closing a little bit and fascinating and and every single movement, grunt, puke and fart is delightful for quite a while, you know. And we had quite a good system. So when I did start going to work again, I'd usually come back, say, between midnight and 3 a.m. So I was always one, because of not drinking and stuff, I was always one for coming back from gigs.
Yeah.
Even in like Leicester, Nottingham or whatever.
Yeah.
And if I was going back the next day, I'd still come back, even before we had kids.
Yeah.
So I'd often get in at sort of midnight and happily be awake till 3 a.m.
Yeah.
So I was able then with the night feed to scoop the kids up, basically bring them to Soph, be awake, change them or whatever.
Yeah.
And she could do that quite blissed out night feed that people sort of dream of, but very rarely happens because the logistics are hard.
Yeah.
And then just sort of be there to settle them back down while she slept on. And then the trade-off for that was I didn't do loads of the early mornings.
I did a fair few, but
you know. Also, I've because of work, I guess, and travel and blah, 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 changing my sleep pattern has never been difficult for me.
No, right.
I don't go, oh, it's all difficult now. I'm just like, there's less of it.
And there'll
be more of it.
Yeah, you know. It's funny, were you talking about, you know, our parents being, you know, at the golf course, when we, and actually our generation of men have massively, as our generation of women have massively changed, you know, what their parents' generation have done. I think, I mean, I don't know if you can comment on this or maybe through the prism of your relationship with your father, but my brother is quite hands-on dad. I remember him saying, him sort of thinking, I think the key to love is the care. So actually, if you're doing that every night and changing their nappy and, you know, getting up and waking up and doing all those kind of like very, very kind of mundane, regular things and meeting their needs, then the love, it just deepens.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a sort of film cliche, isn't it? But the idea of the guy sitting at the end of a bar angrily announcing, I love my kids.
Yeah.
Like, go home then.
Yeah.
Go home.
Yeah.
Go and be at home.
Yeah.
You know, it is. It's very largely what you do. I was definitely hands on. Mm. And Sophie was better at it than I was. More organized, more able, more thorough. Definitely. I mean, look, so there's breastfed shits that sort of smell like porridge and they're all right.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's when they've had their first spoonful of
actual food
and like that, what's in the nappy goes from being sort of not nice, but sort of very benign, warm porridgey thing to an absolute toxic horror show. And it's shocking. That is absolutely shocking. The first time you swear at your child, where you take the nappy off and go, oh, you little fucker. Jesus. And how do they jet it up their back?
How do they do that?
And
I think
why?
It's the nappy that does that,
it must
isn't
be. But it must be coming out with enough force that the nappy can change its direction and it still has momentum.
I'll tell you a story hot off the press.
Yes.
So Zach still wears a nappy a night.
Mm-hmm.
And they've both been a little out of sorts recently.
Yeah.
And the occasional exploding poos.
Yeah.
And this morning, Zach was playing in the kitchen and then suddenly went, oh, poo, and some poo had basically, he was sitting on the floor, had like come out of the top of his nappy
up and over
and onto the floor. And as you know, we have a small puppy.
Yes, instant cleanup.
And I watched in horror before I could sort of, it was all in slow motion, little puppy ran, licked it like a bit of ice cream.
Yeah.
And I
and off
screamed
it goes.
So much, David. Yeah, it was absolutely
You screamed
disgusting.
Today. But when that happens next week, you'll be like,
thanks.
Yeah, thanks, pup. Nice job.
And then we'll
reach the...
Hey, come on. The
good girl.
The floor,
good girl.
yummy, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Come on, get it sorted.
That was interesting, but why do... we talk about something else now.
Then Emily's finger came off.
What?
Emily cut her finger off.
What, no?
Off.
Seriously?
I am the guy who, you know when you have kids in the house and an adult will go, don't slam the doors.
Yeah.
I'm the guy who brings kids in, grabs my daughter by the wrist and goes, is this what you want? Is this what you want? You will cut your finger off. And they're like, ah. Yeah. Em and Alf were playing hide and seek. Oh, she went in a cupboard and she was trying to... it was like giggly, runny hide and seek. She was at sort of crawling, cruising stage and Alf was two or something. She grabbed a door and tried to pull it shut as he grabbed the door and either was trying to get to her or close it as well. I don't know. And cut her finger off. And I was downstairs and Sophie came down with Em screaming and went, she was like a Jedi. She went, we need to go to the hospital.
Oh my God.
Like just Zen master.
Yeah.
And I went, okay, just can you just give me a second? And then she went, right now. And I turned around and she was holding Em in one hand and then in her other hand,
the finger,
Emily's finger. Yeah.
What's it like now? Totally fine.
It's okay. They sewed it back on. It's all right. It's all right. When she's fully grown, there may be some stuff to do with it. It gets painful when it's really cold. But they sewed it back on. But it was, I mean, I was useless. I mean, I wasn't actually. I got us, we rang an ambulance and they said it would be a while. And I went, we're going in the car.
Yeah.
And I drove on and off bus lanes and the pavement and everything else and got us to the hospital really quick. And, you know, so I wasn't useless, but my God, I felt utterly helpless. And just, you're just that absolute feeling of my baby's been hurt. And there's that shit thing that people with kids say to people who either don't have kids or don't yet have kids or whatever, like, until you're a parent, you don't know. And it is a shit thing. And I know that people without kids absolutely detest it. And it's totally and utterly, completely true in my experience.
It is in that situation. People tend to use it in lots of other situations. So I remember people saying things like, you know, you'd hear, a story of Madeleine McCann. Maybe that's a bad example, but you'd hear something whereby children, you know, child refugees or something, and you go, unless you're a parent, it's like, I can still really mind a great deal about this. Yeah, exactly.
But it was really just, I suppose with hindsight, funnily enough, we were talking about this yesterday, because Sophie was just like,
this is what we need to do.
This is what we need to do. Tick, 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 tick.
Until she then collapsed later.
Yes.
Yeah,
oh, my God, yes. Yeah. And she was talking about that yesterday. She was like, my brain and body just did what it needed to do. And then Emily was safe.
Yeah.
And I think out of surgery, I think, then it was just like... Yeah. Oh, and by then I was coming up into, okay, here are the practical measures that need to happen. And yeah. And, you know, like, again, the NHS were just amazing.
Yeah.
She ended up, it's quite weird. So it was the top half of her ring finger.
Yeah.
Which also, there's a weird dad moment. It took me, from memory, it's a long time ago, but seconds before I went, oh, her ring finger.
Did you?
Yeah.
Really?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow.
It took seconds. Yeah. That's a weird thing, isn't it? I don't know if that's some really shitty patriarchal response, but...
Really... It's funny. I mean, I remember when... latterly, when I was single, and people would say things like, you know, there'd be a group and, you know, they'd say halfway through the evening, he's got a wedding, you know, a wedding ring on. I go, I saw that within seconds of... Do you know what I mean? I was just like my...
Oh, that's
there's
that's
a kind of thing where...
Scan
not,
thing,
not,
yeah.
even, not even... Not... Because I wasn't that kind of person, but it was that kind of thing where you're doing it without thinking.
I did that for a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're sort of...
You're
aware without being aware you're aware, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. Completely. And you are, because your mind is just, whether you know it or not, your mind is going, you, not you.
It's hunting.
You, not you. Yeah, completely. Just scanning through people.
Yeah.
So, Yeah, yeah. It was really weird. And they the cast they put on it was from her fingertips, obviously, up to her armpit.
Wow.
And I'm still not quite sure why, other than I guess they needed for the whole arm to be as immobilized as possible.
Yeah.
But she was crawling, and there's no way you can explain to a crawling infant, try not to bash this too much.
Yeah.
And it was hilarious because you could hear her coming. You'd hear this. Like her pirate arm went down on the floor and then the rest of her body moved around it.
Dragged along.
Yeah. Exactly. But that was a, obviously, just a profoundly shocking moment.
Yeah.
Bag of peas, by the way. That's how we kept both hand and finger as well as we could on the way to the hospital.
Did you, did it kind of affect things after that? Did it make you less or more anxious as a parent after that?
More anxious around the sound of slamming doors.
Yeah.
You know, when you've got kids, I mean, yours are little, so this is a bit now and more soon when they're playing around the house.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you can hear them and you know they're there
yeah,
and you're
yeah.
and you're waiting for
because
it happens.
Yeah.
But for me after that, the sound of doors,
anything slamming,
I would
or
literally be like, ah.
Open the front door and I can go out.
In terms of your work, did it change your comedy in any way? Did it make it?
No, I tried not to talk about it, actually, because there were a lot of at that time there were actually quite a lot of blokes on the comedy circuit.
Come
off it. Yeah, no, there were. It's hard to imagine now that it's much more equal. It is actually much more equal than it was.
Yeah.
But
more than even when I was.
And look, the things that happen to you, the big, profound things that happen to you, of course, inform what you write about. But I was looking around on the circuit going, you can't do this material because everybody's doing this material. Not everybody,
right,
but loads and loads and loads of people.
Yeah.
So I just avoided it for ages and ages.
Right.
But I wonder with hindsight, let me see. So there was a huge change in my comedy in, when did we go into Iraq?
2002.
Yeah. So that did coincide with when the kids came along. So basically when I started comedy, roughly when Labour came into power and no one really talked about it. It was quite fun to talk about the election and Michael Portillo losing his seat and those sorts of things. But no one really talked about Labour or what was new. People did impressions of Tony Blair, but because nothing had changed for a while. And then the changes early on were quite positive. The regeneration of the kinds of cities that we were going to, we started to see things very gradually shifting. There was definitely a sense of optimism and blah, blah, blah. My comedy wasn't particularly political and I was doing really well. You know, in terms of circuit comedy, I was headlining Jonglers at the time when you could do 3 Jonglers weekends in a month. They paid really well and the gigs were great. And there's this weird rewriting of history. I mean, I was doing material then about whatever I wanted to do material about, and I never changed it for Jonglers, and they were great gigs. Mm-hmm. Occasionally there was a compere on that set a shitty atmosphere in the room, but that was that. Anyway, it was only when we went into Iraq and I, or thereabouts, the build up to that, and I found myself very politicized and very angry and very like, this is worse than a Tory government because what they do isn't about me. It's nothing to do with me. It's some other prick's decision. I didn't vote for them. And of course, they behave like arseholes. Mm. But these are my people and they're about to do something that I think is absolutely despicable. And what's more, I went on, I think, still the biggest march we've had in the UK.
Even bigger than the People's Vote march.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I believe across the country it was close to 2 million people. And the day before the march, Blair announced that he was going to ignore the march.
Yeah.
He said the day before. And I remember feeling horrified and very politicised around that time. And I think it was partly my investment in having voted Labour and seen something beginning to happen and then feeling it all taken away and feeling stupid and all of those sorts of things. But then also I think like having kids made me kind of more, I don't know, just more engaged with all of it. So, but I didn't really talk about it on stage, not for ages. And then the kids got older and more interesting. And then I hope I haven't let them down by talking about them. I'm very conscious of how much is given away about kids. Even in like a podcast like this, you know, like it's all very nice and it's all fine and everything. But we talk about our kids in the public forums, you know, online and on podcasts and on stage in a way that we weren't talked about.
Well, we were talking about this the other day, weren't we? And like how, where's the line with that? Because, you know, I'm quite conscious of it with this, you know, and I do mention their names and I mention stuff that they've done. But yeah, you wonder, are they going to rue the day that I ever did it, you know, in 20 years' time, and go, God, Mum, I can't believe you said that. I think that's what I expect. But the likelihood is they'll be saturated with, there'll be so much information about everybody.
I think that's true.
That they won't give a shit.
I do think that's true. But I still wonder, and this was the conversation we were having the other day, I think that there will be some people, our kids' generation, probably more, your kids are 10 plus years younger than mine.
Yeah.
Who I think are likely, some of them, to find that what their parents have given away about them is too much, and there will be a reckoning. And I do think, actually, for parents, I do think, look at me giving out parental advice, but I do think, like, be mindful about that, about, like, what you're posting. It's not completely yours to give, you know.
You know, I always think that, you know, if I share a picture of Zach tucking into a hot dog, you know, what if he becomes some kind of vegan campaigner? You know, that photo can be... So it's not even just something that's sort of humiliating for a child or whatever. But, you know, it's like...
But it's all the information. Yeah. And actually what's happening...
And will that be really easily searchable for in the future?
What's happening is the boyfriend comes round... And your parents embarrassingly get out your kiddie pictures and go, this is her when she was two. Yeah. And you're sitting there going, Mom!
Yeah.
Well, that's now everything everywhere all the time.
But will it kind of eat itself in the end where you sort of realise that... Because now I feel like we've got to a point where everyone's done or said something that, that, you know, especially if... David said an interesting thing recently about how, you know, if you... That's why they want stars so young, because generally speaking, they haven't done anything wrong yet. If you become a successful, famous actor in your 30s or 40s, the likely it is you will have said and done something.
But
equally, the like, you know, you've had to work to that point. So it's quite hard to ask an 18-year-old to be as good as a 32-year-old.
Oh, and now it happens in reverse. They get them young and then wait for them to disgrace themselves later on.
Yes, well, there's that too. But you sort of think, is there going to be a point where we just go, well, look, we're all fallible.
Yeah,
newsflash.
Well, the internet.
So maybe we don't, you know, you see journalists just scrabbling through ancient tweets and going, well, in 2009, you know, and you just think, well, okay, he did say that, but the context is completely different. It was a different time, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. I don't want to be an apologist for these things, but equally it's like... You know, maybe, hopefully...
But apologist isn't as important as forgivist about these things, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you do or don't have any right to apologise about the things someone's done or whatever, but people, all of us, have to take responsibility for the things that we're going to make ourselves okay with.
Yeah.
And we watch context get stripped away from all of this stuff all of the time.
Yeah.
There's a great episode of The Simpsons. Lots of people will have seen it because it's one of the old ones that's so good. The Gummy Venus de Milo, where Homer is accused. Basically, he's got a gummy suite, and it's stuck to the babysitter's backside.
Yeah.
And he, as she gets out of his car, he grabs it off her bum and goes, sweet, sweet, gummy Venus de Milo, and eats it. And as far as she's concerned, he's pinched her on the bum, and there's somehow video footage of it.
Right.
And then he becomes this monster, and there are people outside his house and all the rest of it. And he keeps protesting his innocence.
Yeah.
And anyway, it gets to the end, and there's a thing on the telly, and basically the same thing's happening to him, and it's really, really obvious that he hasn't done anything wrong.
Yeah.
And Homer's watching it going, boo, boo, like this. And Marge says to him, you know, Homer, I thought you might have learned something from what's happened to you. And he puts his arm around her and goes, Marge, my friend, I haven't learned a thing. It's really funny. But, like, we do watch this happen all the time.
Yeah.
We watch context being stripped away, like the Liam Neeson thing. It's like, for lots of people, that was, right, that's it. Liam Neeson is a lifelong racist who spends his nights hunting black people with a cosh.
But it's so... There was a scientist recently, probably a year or two ago, who said that... And he was talking to a women in science convention, and he said something like he didn't want any women in the lab because they'd cry, or like, it was so horrific.
Wow.
And it was a really ridiculous...
I don't think we can add context to that one and make it cool.
No, but it was like, but it was, but you, I don't know. I mean, I think I looked into that more because I remember reading it and thinking, like, I can't imagine that being the case.
Yeah,
I can't imagine someone saying that. And the context there really for that story is the fact he was talking, because then there'd be lots of people who would sort of say, oh, well, he's of a certain generation. He didn't really mean it. It was a joke and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, well, he was talking to women in a women, like women in science or women working in science convention.
Yeah.
So he should never have said that because it's so demeaning and ridiculous or whatever. But
was he playing for a laugh in the room?
Well,
because you could say that.
So you could, it could be just a terrible dad joke, but actually,
easily.
Do you know what I mean? Like, and he was of that kind of age. But it's that with every story, you just have to. Now you feel like everyone's got to slightly scratch the surface and go, okay, what is the context here?
Yeah,
it's obviously an outrageous thing to say, but like, you know, and actually, the people who complained and made it public were the people in the room, so it was the wrong thing to say, and that was right, you know. But like. But there are lots of stories like that that actually no one at the time was in any way offended.
It was
completely
happening all
understood
the time.
Completely understood the context. And then, you know, that person gets vilified. And I wonder if we just will, hopefully, our children will just be less kind of, you know, crucible-like about it.
We'll see. It's hard to know, though. But I think it's a bit similar to what we were talking about sort of saying you love your kids and doing it.
Mm.
It's a little bit like that in as much as... You know, all sorts of us make, you know, all sorts of people make mistakes, say sorry, but then the test is what's changed.
What do they do with their life,
So, like, there's stuff on my DVD, which I recorded 10 years ago, maybe, something like that, that I definitely wouldn't do now and I'm not okay with.
Yeah.
I'm not deeply ashamed of it. I use the word pikey on it.
Right.
I didn't really know what it meant, and it would. And the broader point was, it was about painting people, using advertising to paint people in a certain light to appeal to similar blah blah blah. You know, there's a context that I understand, but nonetheless, I used a horrible term, like a really horrible racist term that I didn't understand, had no context for, and all the rest of it. Definitely wouldn't do it now.
Yeah,
and. There is, and there's a document. There's other material on there as well that I suspect if I looked at it now, I'd go, which way were you punching?
Yeah, yeah.
That's probably not okay.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether our kids will be better at managing that stuff or whether it will just get much more difficult.
I just think it's really interesting to have, I mean, this is going off the whole thing and we'll finish in a minute, but you know, I have a friend who is 29, and if I'm having a conversation with him about most things, he might be talking about someone he knew at uni or at school. And he'll say, oh, there was this teacher I had at school I really didn't like, and blah, blah, blah. And we had this kind of like argument about such and such. And he goes, look, and he looks in his email on his phone.
Oh, yeah.
And he can find the email conversation they had. And I'm a bit like, oh, what magic is this?
I know,
I can't believe that you could have all that at your fingertips.
Yeah.
But then maybe if you have all of that at your fingertips, you're less judgy over other people, you know, like you will therefore can see in black and white the lame email you wrote to your teacher.
Stop talking! I'm gonna get cross with you.
I'm encouraged by the idea that my kids are better at using the internet than I am.
Mm-hmm.
They've grown up with it. And it's their whole world, so they're at the very least not shocked by a lot of what happens.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were away a couple of weeks ago, and there were like my parents' generation going on and on about the internet and Facebook and all the rest of it, and their understanding of it was a million miles away from what was going on. And my kids, I think, just sat there slightly baffled by the conversation that was being had. Like, well, we know what this is. But then if it does turn, you know, if it turns and you're publicly shamed in your group of friends or whatever, I think that's
huge.
It's scary. I probably, as a dad, I probably worry about that stuff more than most of the rest. And I've had very specific conversations with my children about what they share online.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And saying, you know, like, they're smart, my guys, you know, they're not stupid kids. And they're like, no, I definitely wouldn't share this, that and the other and all the rest of it. And I wouldn't send this, that and the other. But truth be told, you know, I haven't had a drink for 28 years, so there hasn't been that element of it. But, you know, when you're in a thing with someone, a bit horny, a bit lonely, who knows what you will say or do online, you know?
Oh.
I mean, thank God, when I was a teenager, there wasn't the internet.
Oh, my God, yeah. Horrendous.
But then I am thinking about that from the point of view of just airdropping the internet onto the experience I was already having. Who knows if there was digital communication, what might have been different. But, I mean, there were no... So I was a 24-stone goth when I was 16, 17 years old. And the number of interviews where, like, this has come up because I did a stand-up show about it and all the rest of it. And they're like, can you bring in a picture? I'm like, no, there aren't any.
There are no
pictures.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there's one somewhere, I think. There are no pictures at all. And people are like, what?
Yeah.
But no, there are no pictures. Yeah. We didn't take photos.
We didn't do that. Yeah,
no.
Yeah, yeah.
No, like, imagine one of your mates showing up with a camera.
The thing is, I was that mate, so I totally did. Like, I took photos at parties and blah blah. But yeah, like a third of those,
but
would be like people moving like half.
Of course they would,
open,
and like, you'd have been a bit careful because you not only would it be embarrassing to take the photos to be developed,
yes,
but also you had to pay.
Oh,
for
yeah.
the film, like the idea of clicking away.
Oh no! Yes, exactly.
On your,
no, they were definite,
your 36
yeah, you're right.
or your 24 or
yeah.
your 12.
Oh no! They
you
were,
know
they were posed. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
They were sort of specific.
And you're
things.
Like, you know, some idiot wanders across in front of the lens,
yeah,
like
yeah.
you've ruined that.
Yeah, and also you wouldn't. You there would be a couple that were great that might be gone on my pinboard or
yeah,
something
yeah,
or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah,
and the others were just in, you know, sleeves somewhere that probably
yeah.
I still have in a box somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, when I do occasionally see those pictures,
I'll find a picture of you.
My main thought is pale. We were so pale.
Yeah, I know.
Everyone was so pale. I mean, just ill-looking ghosts.
My main thought about it, which is quite sad, is that, and maybe it was just my group of friends, that we just were completely free. As girls, we were completely free. And I'm saying this as a compliment. Of like really, I mean, we cared about what we looked like, but we had no sense of sort of like fashion in the sense that
yeah.
is important now. Like we were just like, oh, I like wearing this kind of thing and you like wearing that kind of thing. And then
yeah.
we wear that to the best of our ability.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
You know, but
yeah.
like we there was just not that, we were much more free in that sense.
Yeah.
And I'm quite wistful about that. I don't think I even feel like that now, and I should feel more like that.
I mean, Emily plays sort of, you know, dress up. Like, there's a lot of makeup and dressing up and all the rest of it. But she's at a school where there's no uniform, and she's already reached the point where she's going. And Alfie said to her, because he'd been there 2 years before her, he's like, yeah, everyone dresses up for the first term. And then gradually they're like, oh, what a faff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she's already reached the point where the hoodie she wears is very cool, but it's definitely a hoodie.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that that's what must be pretty good about having no uniform, in the sense that you just have to get used to who people are on the end of the day.
Absolutely.
Wear your own clothes today when suddenly you're like...
Their school's very progressive. All the teachers are called by their first name and stuff, which took me such a long time to get used to.
Yeah.
Where they'd be like, yeah, Charlie said to me the other day, I'm like, oh, cool, who's Charlie? Is that a friend? And like, no, my history...
He sounds very
my
mature.
History teacher. All right, crikey.
Okay, so my final question is, what advice, apart from pyjamas, what advice would you give to somebody who was just about to have a baby?
I was about to say something, and then I literally, live on air, checked my privilege.
You were going to say, get a nanny.
Well, no, the advice was take more time off than you think. But, you know, I'm lucky.
Yeah.
I had money anyway, and I've got a job that pays well, and I had money when the kids were born. But I see a thing. I'm talking slowly because I'm on the thinnest ice. I see a thing that's happened, which is that with the liberation somewhat of women into the workplace, albeit that they're still paid less, there's a thing like you can have it all. Mm-hmm. You can definitely have it all, mums and dads. And there hasn't yet been a rebalancing of the value of parenthood, of like how incredibly valuable that is as a thing, what it gives to everybody in that picture. And I don't mean the forgotten about housewife or the people who at gigs for years, I don't ask those questions now, but for years would answer just a mum. Like, sorry, I'm sort of slightly garbling around it because the whole subject makes me really nervous. But there's no such thing as just a mum or just a dad. It's a massive thing to do. So with whatever you need financially or to keep the job that you want to have because you want a career and you deserve it and you've worked hard and all of those things, whatever you can do to ring fence time around being a parent, then do it, because it's so valuable. This is such a sort of glib, weird little thing to say, but it's valuable in a way that absolutely nobody can quantify.
No.
And
I totally agree with you, by the way.
I mean, there are people whose careers are compromised by having children.
Yeah.
And in lots of respects, that's terrible. Because there's a way to structure the workplace where that doesn't need to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also like, yeah, that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Because this is a person.
Yeah.
And look, so here's the privilege to own. Number one, a bloke who had kids in the 90s, not that much was asked of me. I didn't compromise my career. I didn't really need to because of the hours I kept. And I had money anyway, right? So I'm saying this from the point of view of someone who's had to make almost no compromises and talking in ideals about other people. And there are no ideals, and I don't, you know.
I think I would have expected. So my mum was a working mum because my parents split up when I was very young. And so she worked, and I always assumed that that's what I would do. So I had sort of the flip that most people have, where I was like, you know, I'd look at my friends' mums who were at home and I'd be like, oh my God, what are you doing all day, kind of thing. And actually, when I had Zach, we were in a position whereby I didn't have to, well, I was already working in a kind of freelance way anyway, so I was kind of making enough money by not actually working 9 to 5 Monday to Friday. But we were also in a position between us that I didn't have to do that if I didn't want to. But again, I think David would sort of assume that I would want to.
Mm.
And it took quite a long time for me to recognise myself and to explain to him. I was like, actually, I'm not staying at home because I have to. I'm staying at home because I want to, because yeah. I'm enjoying this experience. And it's not even what's best for them, because I think there are some situations actually mm. having someone else look after them is going to be beneficial
yeah,
for
yeah,
them
yeah.
in
to
some
every,
way. You know what I mean?
Everybody.
So it's like it's a
yeah.
combination of lots of things. I do know I still need to work
yeah.
a bit because yeah. I that makes me a happier mm. person and therefore, you know, a better mum.
Yeah.
But equally, if I was working all the time and not seeing my kids, I would. I mean, I did do that for a bit after sort of Sadie was yeah. about 6 months. I did that for about 6 months, and I hated it. I was miserable.
Yeah, 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 yeah. It's really hard because there are tons and tons and tons of people for whom, after a few months, 3 months, 6 months, whatever it may be, a compromise to their work is their life is ruined. Because yeah. they can't afford, you know, because house prices are what they are, rents are what they are, childcare costs what it costs. And broadly speaking, the world of work does not facilitate this stuff. So my right, brother yeah. works in insurance, and the insurance industry is a million times better than the banking industry in terms of paternity leave. But actually, if you take all the paternity leave that's on offer, your colleagues will look at you like, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, it's sort of everywhere. And I think it's much more kind of, I think, frankly, it's still much more difficult for mums, you yeah. know, in the workplace and finding the right balance. And the fault is not with parents. The fault is with the world of work.
Yeah, definitely.
And with the way in which we collectively have structured the kind of capitalism that we have. It is not beyond the wit of our politicians, a great many of whom have tried to do exactly
yeah,
this
yeah.
and must understand
yeah.
what it's like. It's not beyond their wits to change it. But there's absolutely no appetite for it.
Yeah. So you would say, spend as much time with your kids as you can. And
spend enough time with your kids. Also, you know.
And also value it, I think.
Yeah.
That's the point, isn't it?
And say when you've had enough as well.
Yeah.
You know, like we're not robots, and your capacity to love your children is endless, but your capacity to enjoy them has limits.
Yeah.
You know, the kids are pricks loads of the time. They're supposed to be. They're supposed to be much more selfish even than a white male stand-up, if you can imagine. But they are. They're selfish little fuckers. And you ought to have enough of them sometimes and know that that's absolutely fine and hand them over. And, you know, it's such an old thing and people sort of nod, yes, we know it's true and blah, 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 blah. But actually, knowing it's true hasn't changed anything. A day in charge of your children for whichever parent is least used to that, which is usually the father, is tiring in a way that the world of work, for the most part, cannot fathom. Now, bear in mind, I've never had a job where I actually have to do anything, you know, with my hands or anything like that, or had any great responsibility. But seriously, I mean, I remember when things changed when the kids were little and I was left as sole parent in charge of them for the first few times, going, well, I mean, obviously I'm not completely used to this, so it has been a bit tiring. And then when you've done it a lot and then you realise, oh no, I mean, this is absolutely exhausting in a way that is, you know, inexplicable. And I do mean inexplicable, because what did you do today?
Yes, exactly. I mean, you can be absolutely
I took the
exhausted.
Kids to the park.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds nice.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, I know. God.
Yeah.
Tell me, yeah.
Yeah. So enjoy them and then say when you've had enough and take whatever time for your children as you can possibly manage.
Thank you so much to Marcus Brigstock for coming to talk to me. Next week, we have Paul Reddy, brilliant actor who has starred in many things recently, including The Bodyguard, Utopia. He also plays the stay-at-home dad in Motherland, which is where you may know him from. Or maybe other things. He is brilliant. Anyway, thank you so much for listening, and I will see you next time.
Bye-bye.